I'm going to do everything that I can to make sure that restaurants don't serve it, stores don't have it sold in their store.
Alaska's congressional delegation vows to fight FDA approval of genetically engineered salmon. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, November 19th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, Matsu health officials look for solutions for a growing crisis.
Alcohol is the drug that wreaks the most havoc in our community, and we don't have adequate treatment for alcohol abuse and addiction.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking rope, chain, and boat anchors from 5 to 3,000 pounds on the web at arcticwirerope.com. The Alaska Marine Conservation Council reminds Alaskans to choose local, sustainably caught seafood when dining out or in. More information at akmarine.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Marine Conservation Council.
It's the announcement the Alaskan salmon industry has long feared. The FDA this morning approved an application for genetically engineered salmon, declaring the product as safe to eat as natural salmon. Critics, including Alaska's congressional delegation, are considering their next steps. APRN's Liz Ruskin reports.
It's primarily an Atlantic salmon, but it has genes from a Chinook and a bottom dweller to make it grow extra fast on less food. It's called Aqua Advantage, and it's the first genetically altered animal approved for human consumption in the United States. Alaska's industry and congressional delegation call it frankenfish. Senator Lisa Murkowski says she's livid the FDA calls it food.
Well, it's not going to be served at my dinner table, ever. And boy, oh boy, I'm going to do everything that I can to make sure that restaurants don't serve it, that stores don't have it sold in their store.
Murkowski, Senator Dan Sullivan, and Congressman Don Young say they will try to pass a bill requiring a label on Aqua Advantage, identifying it as genetically engineered. Farm state lawmakers, though, have fiercely opposed any such labeling requirement, fearing the next step would be mandatory labeling of genetically engineered crops. The FDA has issued guidance for optional labeling of the new fish. Murkowski scoffs.
You think that the Aqua Advantage people are going to volunteer to put a label on that says this is fake, this is genetically engineered, this is a frankenfish? No, they're not going to do it.
The company, Massachusetts-based Aqua Bounty Technologies, declined an interview request. It plans to produce the altered eggs on Prince Edward Island, Canada, and raise them in Panama in covered land-based tanks. The FDA has so far restricted them to those locations. But in a written statement reacting to the news, the company made it clear it hopes the fish will be produced in the U.S., too. Aqua Bounty says America now imports most of its Atlantic salmon, and it expects its product will boost the viability of domestic fish farming. The company insists its fish will never see ocean, and in any case are incapable of reproduction. Opponents in Alaska, though, say the fish could escape and damage wild stocks. The critics have an ally in national environmental groups.
We will continue both educating consumers as well as restaurants and grocery retailers.
That's Dana Pearls, food and technology campaigner for Friends of the Earth, a group that has worked for years to get consumers and businesses to reject Aqua Advantage.
Already there's more than 60 grocery store chains, including Safeway and Kroger, Trader Joe's, Target's, Whole Foods, that have already said they will not sell the GMO salmon regardless of the FDA approval.
She says Friends of the Earth will call on the Obama administration to rescind the decision and also challenge the process the FDA used. In an email, Aqua Bounty said it's too early to discuss how its fish will appear on the market. Since farm salmon grabbed a substantial market share in the 1990s, Alaska has spent millions to pitch its salmon as wild and healthy. Alexa Tonkovich, executive director of the Alaska Seafood Marketing Institute, says ASME can draw on that experience to meet the challenge of engineered fish, too.
you know, ASME will just continue to promote wild, natural, and sustainable seafood and continue to try to differentiate ourselves in the marketplace.
One thing ASME won't do, she says, is bash the new fish. Tonkovich says their policy is not to speak ill of the competition. In Washington, I'm Liz Ruskin.
The state is set to finalize commercial marijuana regulations, but several controversial sticking points have yet to be settled, including rules for on-site consumption. KSKA's Zachariah Hughes reports.
Bruce Schulte is chair of the state's Marijuana Control Board, which has spent months writing rules to determine how Alaskans are allowed to grow, sell, and use marijuana. Schulte says the board will discuss around 50 amendments on Friday, most of them based on feedback submitted from the public.
We received over 500 pages of comments from the public, so a lot of folks are paying attention.
Once the regulations are finalized, they'll go to the Department of Law for review and then on to the Lieutenant Governor for approval. There's a chance that actions from the legislature could disrupt that timeline. Schulte says if things advance on schedule, the state is required to have a permit system in place and begin accepting commercial applications by the end of February.
But then, you know, this is an agricultural product, of course. So, you know, people still have to grow some product and dry it and cure it and prepare it. So if you look at the whole timeline starting at February 24th, we're kind of looking at probably somewhere between June and August to see the first retail stores opening up.
One of the biggest points of friction in the developing regulations is over what's called on-site consumption, which determines whether the state will allow for marijuana cafes or clubs. Draft regulations in their current form don't allow a venue that's similar to, say, a bar, but for marijuana. Schulte says he's submitting amendments that would create a permit option for what he calls marijuana cafes that are based on public input.
Not just from people in the cannabis culture, but also from city officials, notably Juneau and Fairbanks, who have actually requested that businesses of those type be defined in the regulations.
The state's meeting coincides with a new draft document in Anchorage laying out detailed regulations on commercial marijuana in what many expect to be Alaska's largest marijuana market. The ordinance came from the Land Use Committee, chaired by Conservative Assemblymember Amy Domboski, and is being criticized for placing a cumbersome burden on growers and commercial operators. The proposal requires businesses to take steps like forecasting potential amounts of wastewater, receive certification from an industrial hygienist, and keep growing plants organized in orderly rows. It needs assembly approval in order to be enacted. The Marijuana Control Board meets Friday in the Anchorage LIO building, and then again on Monday if they don't finalize regulations by the end of tomorrow. In Anchorage, I'm Zachariah Hughes.
Alcohol sales are coming to Bethel legally for the first time in 40 years. The Alcohol Beverage Control Board granted Bethel two liquor licenses today, one for AC Quick Stop and another for Bethel Spirits, a Bethel Native Corporation subsidiary. The Bethel Spirits license came with the stipulation that BNC move the main entrance of the store to comply with Bethel Municipal Code. The code requires 300 feet between liquor stores and schools. The rise in drug use in the Matanuska-Susitna borough is prompting community action. As KSKA's Ellen Lockyer reports, health officials say counteracting the spread of drug use is everyone's business.
Matsu Health Foundation sponsored a community discussion Monday evening centered on the problems of drug and alcohol addiction. A panel of medical, law enforcement, and behavioral health experts gathered to answer questions from the audience on how communities can address the growing rate of addiction. The personal devastation of heroin use was illustrated poignantly through voices on a video prepared by the Health Foundation.
It caused me to get a 20-year prison sentence.
Not knowing where my son is, and if he's alive or dead.
Well, my brother is also an addict. His children's mother is an addict. And so we're raising our nieces and nephews as well.
According to a Health Foundation survey, Matsu heroin use is about twice the national average. Alaska State Trooper Joe Miner, who works the graveyard shift along with a canine partner, says 70% of his law enforcement activity is linked to drug abuse.
Any night of the week right now, within about 7 to 10 traffic stops, I can find heroin.
Although heroin is cheaper than OxyContin, Miner says current street prices for a tenth of an ounce of the drug make heroin more expensive than gold.
I've never found a burglary that wasn't linked to drugs. I've never found a robbery that wasn't linked to addiction of some sort.
Dr. Jay Butler, the state's chief medical officer, told the audience that inappropriate use of opiate, painkillers, and the use of heroin has doubled in the past decade nationally. And Butler says opiate addiction is viewed now as a public health problem, whereas earlier it was labeled a behavioral health problem. Dr. Melissa Kemberling, director of programs at the Matsu Health Foundation and a trained epidemiologist, says the role of alcohol abuse should not be overlooked in heroin addiction.
Alcohol is the drug that wreaks the most havoc in our community, and we don't have adequate treatment for alcohol abuse and addiction as well as the other drugs.
Kemberling says about 6,200 adults in Matsu are either in drug abuse treatment or should be, and more than 700 youth are at risk for becoming addicted to drugs. But are there enough treatment facilities in the Matsu? Kemberling says no.
We have no detox in the valley. There's only 14 beds in Anchorage, and that's not adequate for the whole South Central population.
Alcohol detox is a life-threatening process and must be medically monitored, but heroin detox is not life-threatening. Kemberling says many heroin addicts can be treated as outpatients, but as it is, the response to Matsu drug users in crisis is provided by nonprofits, which receive state grant funding.
The services either exist or not, depending on whether they get funded, not on the needs of our residents.
Kemberling says the various threads of response to addiction don't always weave together. She says the Health Foundation can work to coordinate the complex network of crisis response, medical treatment, and behavioral therapy necessary to help an addict recover. The Health Foundation has published 2 reports assessing borough health needs, pointing to substance abuse as the number one target. Kemberling says a third report will address prevention.
Nobody focuses upstream on prevention, and that's where we think we can come in as well to make sure that they don't develop these addictions. A lot of our work is to try and decrease child maltreatment, which can often lead to substance abuse later in life.
Addiction is how many people deal with pain, she says, and the childhood trauma that causes it. She says, we have to start dealing with the pain. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the Alaska Quarterly Review presents fiction, poems, and even music compositions in its latest edition.
We have an Alaskan vision, but we don't focus on exclusively Alaskan content.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Crowley, providing marine petroleum distribution and energy support services throughout Alaska since 1953, supporting business development while helping safeguard the environment. More at CrowleyAlaska.com. And by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
Alaska writers have a range of talents as large as the state they hail from. The Alaska Quarterly Review captures the best of that work and the writings of authors from across the world into an annual collection that has garnered literary praise for decades. UAA professor and AQR editor Ron Spatz started the publication at UAA 33 years ago and is still at the helm. The collection of nonfiction, fiction, and poetry is always masterful, but this fall's edition of the AQR devotes more than 80 pages to the musical artistry of John Luther Adams. Adams is a Pulitzer Prize and Grammy-winning composer. He recounts his friendships with poet John Haynes and composer and conductor Gordon Wright in his composition, They Were My People. Editor Ron Spatz says Adams wanted to print the music for 2 compositions in the AQR.
And the more I thought about it, the more exciting it was, because it added another layer, another kind of meta to the whole context of the musical literature and the language of literature being together in the same place with the stories of these people. Most other venues, I don't think, would have been willing to devote the necessary space to get this magnificent result, which I think John attains in They Were My People.
Have you ever printed music within the pages of the Alaska Quarterly Review before.
Well, not in this way, no. We've published, Facing Translations, and we've had some inset things from time to time. But this is like, this is a major work. And actually, they were my people, he says, I will never see their kind again. I think that this trifecta, if you will, of these three major forces coming together, how amazing is that? And there are things that will never happen again because the time was different when, John Haynes was up on his homestead at Richardson. Gordon Wright was at Fairbanks in the Fairbanks Symphony. And then John Luther Adams came up. That time doesn't really exist anymore. The world has changed quite a bit in that 30 to 40 year period, including the fact of the wildness of Alaska is changed some as well.
The AQR gets rave reviews nationally. How do you select stories for inclusion each year? It seems like there must be a lot of pressure. You mentioned that stories come in from across the world. Do they have to have some connection to Alaska?
We've actually been criticized within Alaska for not focusing exclusively or almost exclusively on Alaska. One of the reviews that we recently got last year and that appeared was posted on the New York Review of Books. It said, we're not provincial. So we live here. We are sustained by Alaska. And we have an Alaskan vision. But we don't focus on exclusively Alaskan content.
Talk to us a little bit about the inclusion of Eva Salaitis's work within this AQR.
Well, Eva's an Alaskan-based writer who we've published seven times over the years, which means that she's one of the most published writers in our 33-year history of publication. She is an amazing person and writer. The writer part is that she writes things, in my mind, that are both beautiful and true. So she is at the top, anyway, with a small group of writers. But what makes her situation now so compelling is that she's facing end-stage breast cancer. And she continues to write about things related to it. But she's facing all of these problems herself. And she writes this amazing essay called Man of Letters about telling her father's story from little scraps that she was able to put together. It's an amazingly powerful piece, beautifully written, poetic, and, lingers in one's memory.
Ron Spatz is the editor of the Alaska Quarterly Review. A celebration for this year's AQR featuring readings and a concert will take place in Anchorage at the Blue Holloman Gallery on Friday night at 7 p.m. When the Nakechot Inupiaq Immersion School opened in Kotzebue, its founders turned to Bethel's Ayapun Yupik Immersion School for guidance. With Ayapun's building destroyed earlier this month in a fire, its Inupiaq sister school is stepping in to offer support. KYUK's Anna Rose MacArthur reports.
Images of the fire flashed across TV screens statewide. Wanda Noyak-Baltazar and her 15-year-old son were watching the news of the devastation at their home in Kotzebue when the son, Anoluktuk, turned to his mother.
He said, Mom, we should do something. Akka, let's do something. Sure, son, what would you like to do? Let's do a bake sale and raise money and send them to the kids down there.
Noyak sprang into action, calling and emailing former Nakechot teachers, alumni, and parents. Noyak is a former Nakechot teacher herself, and all three of her children, including Anoluktuk, graduated from the Inupiaq school. After rallying community members, Noyak turned to Nakechot itself.
I asked them if they wanted to participate, and we could do it together as a way of showing solidarity from one immersion school to another.
Janine Saito, Nakechot's director, agreed. Saito says Nakechot is the only Inupiaq immersion school in the nation, and its founders modeled the program after Ayapun when the Inupiaq school opened 18 years ago. Noyak's oldest child graduated in Nikechot's first class, and Noyak says she remembers meeting with Ayapun teachers and directors when Nikechot was first beginning.
We have so much in common when it comes to pushing for the strength of the language, and there's so much passion involved in keeping the language alive wherever you are.
Fueled by the shared mission, the bake sale set up inside the Kotzebue Post Office lobby on Friday and raised over $1,000 for Bethel School. Community members, many of them connected with Nikechot, made bread, soups, pies, and cakes. Nikechot students baked cookies, and retired preschool teacher Ida Anateyuk Biesmeyer ran the booth for the day. Again, Noyuk.
She's almost 80. But she sat at the desk and recruited, and she said people were so giving that they would just give $20, $30, or whatever they had in their pocket just to donate.
Saito says when she arrived to help clean up, everything had sold out. In Bethel, I'm Anna Rose MacArthur.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
the Red Dog Mine, committed to environmental excellence. Wells Fargo, extending its support of Alaska residents beyond banking by supporting the programming of public radio throughout Alaska, giving back to the community. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far.
And by
Condor Airlines, with nonstop service from Ted Stevens International Airport to Germany and beyond. More information available on condor.com. Condor, born to fly.
A lab has identified a possible cause of death for one of the two brown bears that died in front of the highly popular bear cams in Katmai National Park last month. KDLG's Hannah Colton reports.
After thousands of viewers watched a spring cub die in late October, the animal's remains were sent to a lab in Madison, Wisconsin. Katmai's chief of interpretation, Roy Wood, says the cub tested positive for canine adenovirus, an infection that's also found in cats, dogs, and wolves.
It's called canine infectious hepatitis, and it causes liver damage and lesions in the esophagus and in the nose. And when the symptoms present themselves, they do present similar to what we saw with the cub on the camera, which is loss of motor skills, lethargy, and then ultimately convulsions, seizures, leading up to death.
This is not the first time this disease has been found in bears in southwest Alaska. A 1998 study showed 14% of brown bears on Kodiak Island and the Alaska Peninsula had been exposed to infectious hepatitis. In the recent Katmai case, Wood says they can't be certain that the hepatitis is what actually killed the cub, but tests show the virus was present, and that means it could spread to other animals.
When you spend time around bears, one thing you'll notice is that they go up and smell and lick anything unusual. So they will go sniff a pile of feces, or they will go sniff where another bear has urinated. And so even without consuming the flesh, it's possible that a number of other bears may have come in contact with the pathogen.
Within days of the cub's death, a large male bear also lay down and died within view of cameras. Wildlife technicians went out and dissected the body to collect samples, and Wood invited the army of viewers along to help investigate.
I posted the photos with disclaimers. It's very graphic, and you know, don't go there if you're likely to be upset by this. But for those of you that are interested in viewing the science, here's the link. You can go to it. And I said, now, nobody talk about what you're seeing in the photos for 30 minutes, and then I'll come back, and we want to see if examining the photos and looking at your notes, if we all come back with the same identification for the bear.
Wood figured no more than a handful of people would be interested in studying gory photos in the name of science. But as it turned out,
within the 30-minute allotment that I gave them to examine the photos, I think there was close to 2,000 views. And those were not the 100 or so people that were on the cams chatting with us and were very, very upset. These were a whole additional group of people that we hardly ever interact with.
The tissue samples from the adult bear came back negative for infectious hepatitis as well as rabies. But Wood says that's about all they were able to test for because the samples were too decayed by the time they reached the state veterinarian in Fairbanks.
We suffered the same sorts of delays that many of us are used to having when we ship stuff from the grocery store in Anchorage out to our homes in the bush. You just miss a flight and it doesn't get on the next one. And now you've got, you know, a box of mold instead of the lettuce you thought you were getting. And we kind of had that happen here where there were some delays getting it all the way to Fairbanks. And so we missed out on some test opportunities.
Wood says biologists aren't overly concerned at the moment, but they do plan to test for hepatitis, among other things, in a study of Katmai bears next summer. For now, the cameras at Brooks Camp are down due to ice and snow that covered the solar panels and caused an outage. Wood isn't sure whether Explore.org will get them turned back on this winter or wait till next summer. In Dillingham, I'm Hannah Colton.
Growing up in Bird Creek, Heather Kelly learned about the challenges of carrying food in the backcountry. After studying sports nutrition at Western Washington University, she returned to Alaska to launch her own line of dehydrated backpacking food. This week, she held a tasting event as a fundraiser aimed at expanding her business.
One of the reasons that I started Heather's Choice was because I needed to fit all of my food into a bear canister for a three-day pack rafting trip. And I couldn't fit all my healthy whole foods into this little black box. So it was about 5 years ago that I got my first little five-tray dehydrator. And I was going on a 25-day trip rafting through the Grand Canyon. And I knew I wanted to eat healthy the whole time that I was on the river. And so I took it upon myself to dehydrate 50 pounds of food. And so here we are 5 years later, and now started my own line of foods.
I've had some of the chili and some of the chowder. And this is the first time I've tried the buckwheat, and it's excellent.
The breakfast cereal, I was like, I could see myself having that before work every day.
It's a nice refreshing change from the typical backpacking fare that you usually end up going through.
And so right now we have our smoked wild-caught Alaskan sockeye salmon chowder, which is my personal favorite. We also have a dark chocolate chili. We have an elk shepherd's pie. It's made with 100% grass-fed elk. So it's a never-ending creative endeavor for me to always be looking at recipes and wondering how I could turn it into a Heather's Choice meal, or trying to take some of my favorite meals that I make at home and then putting them on my dehydrator trays, taking them out in the backcountry and saying, wow, this is really, really good. And we should start offering this to people.
Heather Kelly is launching a line of dehydrated backpacking foods called Heather's Choice. To see a video of the event by Alaska Public Media's Eric Keto, go to alaskapublic.org. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. We had reports tonight from Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Zachariah Hughes and Eric Keto in Anchorage, Anna Rose MacArthur in Bethel, Ellen Lockyer in the Mat-Su Valley, and Hannah Colton in Dillingham. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Monica Goki is our web editor. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
BP Alaska. As part of their commitment to Alaska, BP and their employees are investing in over 400 education and service organizations in communities across the state. More at alaska.bp.com. Crowley, providing marine petroleum distribution and energy support services throughout Alaska since 1953, supporting business development while helping safeguard the environment. More at crowleyalaska.com.
And by
Alaska Business Monthly Magazine, publishing statewide news about Alaska businesses and industries for over 30 years. News, information, and subscriptions are available online at akbizmag.com. Celebrate National Philanthropy Day in Alaska and honor outstanding small businesses like Two Friends Gallery for their work to make Alaska a better place to live and raise Alaskan families. Join the celebration on Friday, November 20th at the Dena'ina Center. Visit afpalaska.net. This message sponsored by Alaska Public Media and AFP Alaska.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.